Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for July 23rd, 2018. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Tonight on our show, our special guest is Phil Valentine, who has been in the entertainment business for many years, and among his many achievements have been two documentary films of interest to those serving in the military, as well as to anyone who cares about those who serve. Now, before I turn things over to Richard Hurley, I would like to remind our listeners that we are also a call-in show, so you can let us know what's on your mind tonight and call in to ask questions of our special guests. Our toll-free call-in number covering the entire United States is 1-888-627-6008. Those of you just grabbing your pen and paper, let me give you the number again. Our toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Let's go over to Richard Hurley. Good evening, Richard.
Hey, David. Thanks very much, and hope everyone is doing well this evening. It is my privilege to introduce Phil Valentine on our show tonight. Phil's experience is impressive. He started his career as an actor more than 30 years ago. He has performed in movies, plays, and commercials worldwide. He became a producer and director when he co-wrote and produced and directed The Richard's Riddle, a successful mystery dinner theater show, which is still running after 25 years. His original and creative productions earned him a position with the Philip Morris Company as creative consultant and operations manager for the Marvel Adventure Team, the largest consumer promotion in American history at the time. From there, Phil began writing and directing shows around the world for companies like Walt Disney, Universal Studios, Fox, New Line Cinema, Six Flags, and many others. After writing the very successful Fox Family Channel original movie, Ice Angel, Phil was hired to produce the independent film, Siren, which led him to write and direct the independent sitcom pilot Gag. Phil became a performance coach, teaching not only actors, but salesmen, lawyers, and other business executives about how to become better presenters in a seminar based on his original book, Why Can't You Tickle Yourself? His book and seminar are believed by some to be one of the most intensive and original techniques of performing today. Phil travels the country as one of the nation's leading team-building facilitators for best corporate events, the fastest-growing team-building company in the country. Most recently, Phil is becoming multi-award-winning documentary filmmaker with the critically acclaimed success of his most recent films, Who Will Stand and Women of War documentaries, which follow the plights of soldiers returning from war. So let's welcome Phil Valentine to the Veterans News Hour. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing great, and thank you very much for having me on.
And thanks for being on our show. How's everything out there in Las Vegas?
Well, it's hot. It's going to be 114 tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the past few years, you've been focusing your films on veterans issues, and we're going to get back to that later in the show. But you really have a very impressive background leading up to your work with veterans. And if you'd be so kind as to give our listeners a little bit of your background.
Well, like I said, and thanks for doing all that research. I think you've pretty much listed everything I've ever done. But, you know, I did. I started out as an actor. I, you know, took an acting class in college when I was in my 20s and then basically went on to business. And then when I was about 25, I, you know, was sort of taking stock of my life, which I thought, you know, at 25, I thought I'd lived half my life already. But that's because I was 25. And I really wasn't happy in business with what I was doing. And I started thinking back of, you know, that most of my fun years were behind me. And I really started thinking back of when's the last time I really loved what I was doing. And it was when I was in an acting class in college, which I only took as an elective. So then I thought to myself, you know, acting is a business. Maybe I can take what I've learned for the last 7 years in business and apply that to something that I was passionate about, like acting. So that's what I did. I sort of changed my course of what I wanted to do and be, and I used my business sense to try to become successful at acting. Not only to be a good actor, but, you know, there's a lot of actors out there, you know, that end up in the tabloids because they're a little wacky. So I thought, you know, maybe if I could convince producers and who are really business people, you know, that I would be good for their film from a business standpoint, that, you know, maybe I would get more work. And that actually did work. I did find out that the most successful actors aren't always the best actors. So I did that for a while, and I liked it. It's very competitive from the acting standpoint. And I really believe there are two reasons why people become actors, or really performers of any kind. They either have the need to be the center of attention, which most of the general public thinks that's all of us. That's why anybody gets into acting. Or they have the need for self-expression. And the difference is really, if you have the need to be the center of attention, the size of your role in the film or play is more important than the quality of the project. If you have the need for self-expression, the quality of the project is more important than the size of your role. So I was really a self-expression person. So then I started writing, and I loved doing that, and I started directing, and then I started producing. And I really love that more. I haven't really done a lot of acting, you know, probably in the last 10 years. But I loved every minute of it. But I really do love writing and producing and directing. And because of that, as fate would have it, I went from writing shows and movies and plays to directing shows and movies and plays. And that ultimately led me into documentary filmmaking.
Now, I know in, you know, you and I have talked prior to tonight. In 2005, you kind of had a little change in direction. You got a call from an attorney about doing a day in the life. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was, you know, I got a call from a lawyer. His name is Gerald Gillock. He's become a very good friend of me since 2005. Originally, he had called me because he had a great idea for a movie, which I hear all the time. And I believe people do have great ideas for a movie. Very few of them actually write it down. And then there's a whole process from coming up with an idea for a movie to actually making a movie. So he hired me to write a script based on this story that he had, which actually was a good idea. But in the process of that, when he saw some of the films that I had done, he had said to me, you know, I have these day in the life videos that I need someone to do. Maybe you'd like to do that for me. And basically, a day in the life video is something that medical malpractice attorneys do a lot. You know, when you have a client, you know, who is a victim of some medical malpractice suit, you know, what they want to do is they want the jury to really get a feel for how much this particular, case, how much this has changed their life. It could be that somebody had an operation for something, a simple procedure, kidney stones, and the anesthesiologist screwed up somehow, and they come out, you know, being, you know, in some way affected for the rest of their life. And they want the jury to know how much this has affected their life. So what I do is I go and I talk to family and friends, and we get pictures and home videos of them so that we can give the jury a real feel for how vibrant this person once was. And then it very quickly turns into a video about what this person has to do every day just to get through a day and how dramatic of a change that is. And when you hire somebody that's a filmmaker that knows how to emotionally manipulate people, that's pretty much what we do, then basically what I try to do is I really want the jury to feel sorry for, you know, the plaintiff, to realize that this person is forever changed, not by any fault of their own. And if I can do it really well, you know, anybody that watches this 5 or 10 minute video would be, you know, would be in tears. Now, of course, the defense, the last thing the defense wants is a jury that's in tears, because that's not good for them. So most of these day-in-the-life videos, as dramatic as they may be, as emotional as they may be, as touching as they may be, never get seen by a jury. And that's really the intent. You know, there is disclosure, so of course the defense has to see what the prosecution, you know, wants to present, this being a day-in-the-life video, so of course they're going to watch the video, and of course the prosecution hopes that they watch this video and say, we do not want the jury to see this, and hopefully they'll settle. So I ended up doing a lot of those, and other lawyers found out about it, and they would contact me, and we ended up doing a lot of them, and then I was really became known as the guy that can make anybody cry in 5 minutes. And once I did that, this same attorney that started this for me said, you know, I want you to do a documentary on, at that time, it was amputee soldiers, because he had a client that was a Vietnam vet that was a double amputee. In an unrelated case, you know, the case that he was representing him for was not like the stuff that you guys do. It was an unrelated case. But in getting to know his client, he realized that 60 years later, this guy still suffers with combat post-traumatic stress disorder. And this, it was a soldier. He was in the Army, and he told him, he said, 100% of amputees suffer with post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's something that, at that time, you know, the general public was completely unaware of. And he said, I want to do a documentary on amputee soldiers and their struggles with combat post-traumatic stress. So that's how it started. And very early on in doing the research for that, and the film Who Will Stand is really what that originally was going to be. But very early on in interviewing combat service members from every branch of the military, I found out, not being military myself, I found out that anyone who serves in combat is going to come back with some level of post-traumatic stress disorder, from maybe mild to severe. But for the most part, you don't have to lose a limb to get PTSD from being in combat. So I went back to Jerry, and I said, I don't think this should be about amputees. This has to be about everyone who serves in combat, everyone who serves in the military. You know, that's what this has to be about, because I had learned that combat post-traumatic stress disorder is different from the types of post-traumatic stress disorder that lots of us experience through different types of events.
Now, going back, I want to touch on that in a second, but the day in the life, I just wanted to kind of, to, for our listeners, because one of the things that David and I insist upon our clients do is we have them do a statement. And the statements that we have them do are much like your day in the life, which is starting with right prior to the deployment, everything that happened to them in service, and then going forward to where they are today. And I was very fascinated when I learned about, you know, your work with the Day in the Life, because part of my work with veterans, I did medical malpractice and other civilian law, and we used to use these all the time. And they are very powerful. And when I started doing the veterans work, I wanted to utilize that same idea and in the form of these statement of claims. And they are very powerful. And if any veterans out there listening and you have a case pending, you should go to your representative, whether it's a DAV or a VSO or your lawyer, and let them know. They all know about doing a statement of the claim. And the VA actually gives you a form which is about half a page long. But it's important that you write beyond that half page and write 3, 4, 5, sometimes 10 pages of your life, your story. And as Phil just remarked about using a day in the life and the impact that it could have on the jury, these statements have an impact on the examiners and the decision review officers and potentially the Board of Veteran Appeals when they're looking at your case and reviewing your case, because finally they get to put a person, a picture of a person behind the file. So I just wanted to kind of reiterate that in the importance of what Phil just addressed when it comes to a day in the life. Phil, when it comes to the PTSD, June was, I think I told you that June was PTSD Awareness Month, as enunciated by the VA. And we've been doing a lot of work with our veterans. And as you said, I think virtually every veteran we have has a form of PTSD. What impact have you seen when you did your work, PTSD, on the family? David and I always have said that it's not just the effects of PTSD on the veteran, but on the veteran's family as well. So what did you find in that when you were doing your movie?
Well, that's a very important point because, you know, everyone, you know, support for the troops is at an all-time high. And I think recently we've been very lucky that the general public tends to separate the war from the warrior. And, of course, we understand that they're amazing people and they've been through a traumatic experience to have to go into combat, to have to watch people die, especially people that you almost consider family, that's devastating. But we do forget that when these guys come back home, men and women, when they come back home, the way that they've been changed is going to change their families as well. Even before they come home, when you realize the family members of a service member are people that spend months and months, if not a year or more, without that very important person in their family. There are children that are growing up without mothers and without fathers for big chunks of time. And then when that person does come home, if they've been in combat or, God forbid, they've been injured and they might have lost a limb or whatever, you are not going to get the same person back that you sent to war. And you're going to have to deal with that on a daily basis. And all of the things that they struggle with, you are going to struggle with them. And we tend to not forget about it, but we don't even really think. And then when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. But we don't think about how it's going to affect the family. And it affects the family tremendously, especially if they come back injured and they're no longer able to support their families. And that's a big deal. And there's just a plethora of things that, you know, we can talk about. And everything that affects a service member directly affects their family. And they struggle a lot. And a lot of these family members a lot of times feel like they're the only ones who are dealing with that. Even they don't know that all the other service members' families are dealing with the same struggles that they are. And they're very traumatic as well. They are suffering with secondary PTSD. And it's very real, and it's very devastating.
You know, one of the things that I've learned since I've been doing veterans law is a concept called the Great Divide. And I'm sure you probably ran across this. And the Great Divide essentially is you take two veterans who meet, you know, maybe at the post or at the American Legion or somewhere, and they're having a couple of beers, and they just turn around and they say, yeah, you're a veteran, I'm a veteran, where'd you serve? Vietnam, I served Vietnam. And that's the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. They don't need to talk anymore because they both know what each other went through, and they don't share their experience, which is, unfortunately, failure rule one. They don't share their experiences. Then they go home, and this is the other part of the Great Divide. and they go home to their wife and kids, and now, you know, do you think they go home and they would share, again, their experiences and kind of talk about what's bothering them, but they don't do that when they get home. Why? Because they don't understand.
No.
And
yeah.
Consequently, the veteran is stuck keeping all this inside, and that's why we talk about peer-to-peer counseling these days and trying to get the veteran to talk about the experience. I'm sure you ran into that when you were doing your film. What can you share with us about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, before you go into basic training, if somebody were to tell you the things that you were going to do and the things that you were going to see, you almost wouldn't believe it. But we train these people. You know, a lot of people think the police department and the military are very similar, and they're really not so much as you would think, because the police department, when they go through their training, they are trained to protect and serve. And in the process of doing that, they hope that it never happens, but they may get into a situation where they would have to shoot somebody. And in that situation, they might kill somebody. For most police officers, that never happens. But the main difference between the police department and the military is the military, you are trained to kill. That's what you're trained to do. And it does take a long period of time to take a normal person who most of us think that killing is wrong and turn them into somebody who is trained to kill. And when they get deployed, you know, into a combat zone, they're very likely going to have to kill somebody in that process. Now, you take somebody out of a normal, everyday, all-American living, you take them through basic training, you train them how to be violent and how to kill and how to do their job, and then they go off and they do that. And when they're in that environment surrounded by other people who have the same training, they end up doing these things because over and wherever it is they're fighting, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever, that becomes your normal. Then you come back into an environment that you left a long time ago, and where people believe that killing is wrong, or their biggest, you know, problem of the day is what type of cereal to buy for breakfast tomorrow or whatever. And when they come back into their environment, they realize, if I explain to you the things that I did and the things that I saw, you're going to think I'm crazy. And there's no way for me to explain this to somebody who hasn't been through it and not sound crazy. So they don't say anything because they don't want to sound crazy. They don't want people to think that they're evil or dangerous or whatever. So they realize that even their family members are not going to understand what they've seen, what they've done, and what they're struggling with now, so they keep it inside. But it is going to come out. It comes out in nightmares, in sleeplessness, in hypervigilance, you know, and then that goes into, you know, unemployment, divorce, domestic violence, all of these things that almost every combat soldier struggles with. Homelessness, unemployment, all of that stuff is directly related to untreated post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's a great summary of PTSD.
Rick, can I interject here?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Phil, that's the most powerful description of what veterans go through that I've ever heard. And I'm a veteran myself. I mean, I really applaud your insight, and I'd like to ask you to tell us more about the two films that you made that I know veterans will want to know about. The film Who Will Stand and Women of War.
I know you know, in addition to Who Will Stand, your other movie, the documentary you did regarding women veterans and military sexual trauma, which is another form of PTSD, which seems to be overlooked in a lot of when I'm dealing with the VA, they seem to kind of pass that one by. Why don't you fill us in on your experiences with that?
Sure. And once again, just like Who Will Stand was originally supposed to be about amputees and then became about combat post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the comments that people made after Who Will Stand came out, people said, a couple of people had said, how come you didn't interview any female veterans? And my answer was, well, I only met two, and neither one of them wanted to talk. So then our executive producer, Gerald Gillock, once again said, let's do a documentary on how combat post-traumatic stress manifests itself differently in women than men, because women are different than men. Do they manifest combat PTSD differently? Let's do a documentary on that. So that was the original intention. The very first service member, female service member that I interviewed, 5 minutes into the interview, I hadn't even asked a difficult question. She was just very nervous about being on camera from the beginning. But 5 minutes into it, she broke down and she started crying. And she told me this horrific story about being raped by her drill instructor in boot camp. And she said to me, have you ever heard the term military sexual trauma? And I said, no, never heard of that. And she said, do yourself a favor. Every female service member you interview, ask them if they have ever been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted or raped during their time in the military. And I was like, okay. So I did that. Every single service member that I interviewed, except two, and we interviewed hundreds, said that they had been sexually assaulted or raped, or at least the minimum, they had been sexually harassed, almost every single one of them. So once again, I went back to Jerry and said, we are not doing a documentary on how PTSD manifests itself differently in women. We are doing a documentary on military sexual trauma because it is rampant in the military, and I want to find out why. This is horrific. And that's what that documentary became about, and it was just eye-opening. The good thing about it is we did have the aha moment. We did have, I ran into a psychiatrist named Dr. Mick Hunter, and he wrote a book that I had read, very disturbing book in a lot of ways, that's called Honor Betrayed, Sexual Assault in Today's Military. And we interviewed him, and he really did break it down to where everyone could understand not only what military sexual trauma and military sexual assault is, but exactly why it happens. Because my question was, if this is so rampant in the military, are we recruiting sexual predators? How could everyone in the military be a sexual predator? How is that possible? And he said to me, no, we're not recruiting sexual predators. We're actually creating them. And he broke it down in these very easy-to-understand steps as to why it's happening. And then we absolutely had to do this documentary. And I couldn't wait to finish it because, you know, when you have a certain problem that you want to address with the American public and you want to make them aware, to find out why it happens and to be able to actually give them the solution to it, you can't wait for it to come out because you want this to end. And it is something that we can do something about. And, of course, the military doesn't change the military, so I had to go to Washington. And we sent thousands of copies of Women of War to every politician I could think of and find. And, you know, and I'll tell you, to this day, not a single one has really done it, has used this film to do anything about it. And it's so incredibly frustrating to me.
And so I'll go one step further. In the cases that I had, women struggling with PTSD, all of them were victims of MST.
Yeah.
There's and there's not an exception in my office. And the sad thing is how the VA, and this all comes down from the top, how the VA continually puts the woman veteran off, says, well, we can't service connect it, or you didn't come and, you know, why didn't you complain about it when it happened? I mean, all these stereotypical responses that you see when women are assaulted, So I can only imagine what you went through and how you felt when you sent those 1,000 documentary tapes to the politicians and no one responded. It's very, very sad.
It is. And to this day, when I run into a politician and talk to them about the military sexual trauma, because it's, sometimes it becomes the flavor of the month where it's something they want to talk about to get elected. We're in an election year, and of course this is going to come out, and they're going to talk about how we need to do something about it, we want to do something about it, and they will find out about me, and they'll call me and say, I'd love to get copies of your documentary, and I'll be like, happy to send it to you. And they go, we're going to do something about this, and I go, and if you do, you'll be the first. But I'm very blunt with politicians now because I'm very frustrated with that. And I say to them, but I'm going to expect that you're not going to do anything. And mm-hmm. That's where I leave it. I go, I'll send you as many copies as you want. I'll drive them over there. You can have them today. I'll overnight them. You'll have them tomorrow. I do my part. And I say, when you read this, you will not only understand the problem of military sexual trauma, but you will understand why it happens, and you will know how we can fix it. And I expect you to do something. And then, whatever, they get elected, they start worrying about raising money and other things. I really hate to start. I don't want to get political.
Speaking of your films, to our listeners out there, why don't you let people know how they can possibly get some of your documentary films?
Sure. Well, Who Will Stand is something that anyone can stream for free. If you go to the website, which is whowillstand4us.com, whowillstand4us.com, that's the Who Will Stand website. You can click on the film and you can watch it for free. We've never charged any service member for the documentary when we had thousands of DVDs. We didn't get into this to make money. We got into this to make change. When it comes to Women of War, which I still have on DVD, which is very quickly becoming obsolete, but you can go to that website, which is womenofwardocumentary.com. You can send me an email, and I'll send anybody a copy. I know I put that out on national radio. I'm probably going to run out of copies, but that's okay because we're in the process of putting that on that website so that can be streamed for free as well.
That's awesome. In our prior discussion to tonight, you drew a comparison, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your strategy when you do documentaries. And you compared a Michael Moore film versus a Ken Burns film, and I thought that was very interesting because I've seen both Michael Moore and Ken Burns, and I've seen the similarities and the differences, but you kind of, the way you explained it was enlightening. Why don't you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. When we were going to do this documentary, there's a couple of things that you go through. One is the type of documentary that you want to do. Do you want this to be an awareness piece, so that the general public will see it, like Michael Moore's Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, all of that stuff? It's an awareness piece to get the general public to understand whatever it is your issue is. Or do you want to make a documentary that's really educational, something that you don't really think is ever going to make it into the theaters? It's really going to be something that you sell to, universities and things like that, and it's something that they use in whatever subject matter your documentary is to whatever courses that they teach. Those are two very different things, because educational documentaries don't really have to be that, I don't want to say that they're not interesting, but they're more informative than anything else. An awareness piece is really created to affect people emotionally, and so that they get into an emotional state where it becomes a call to action. So now they get upset or they get angered, and they want to do something about it. So they call their congressman, or they donate money, or they volunteer, whatever it is. But those are two completely different types of films because they have two different agendas. One is basically, those educational films, there's a whole process to, going to universities and filling out forms and explaining what your documentary is, and there's a whole process behind that. It's not very interesting. But they take a look at your documentary, and they go, oh, this will be good. This will be good for our psychology department. This will be good for our history department, whatever it is. And there are people that make those types of documentaries. The awareness pieces, you know, you want to send it out to the masses, so you might go into film festivals or whatever. But two very successful documentary filmmakers have two very different styles. And one is Ken Burns, and his documentaries are excellent. But they are polished, and they are well put together, and you can see that there's probably an army of people behind this thing, putting this thing together, because it's really good. And it's beautiful. Cinematically, it's beautiful. The editing is good. The information is good. It's tight. Now, Michael Moore has a completely different style. It looks like a home movie. It looks like Michael Moore took a camera and went out and discovered the truth. Now, both of these guys have very big budgets when they do documentaries, and they have research people, and they have, you know, a team of people working on this documentary. And it's not that Michael Moore doesn't have the money that Ken Burns has, but he wants the documentary to look not so polished, because then people might think it's a propaganda piece, or it's, you know, really corporate America's behind this thing because, you know, it looks so expensive. He purposely doesn't want his documentaries to look expensive, because if you think that somebody went out with their video camera and they shot this, and because, you know, it moves around, the edits are kind of quirky and jerky, and it looks very amateurish, but because that's the style of it, you just assume it must be true. This is just a guy with a camera, and he went out, and look what he caught. And because it has a very amateur style, that's really not amateurish. That's genius, because people watch his documentaries, and they believe every single word of it.
Very interesting, very interesting. Now, I know in addition to all the entertainment and the filming that you've done, recently you've been involved in some projects in, regarding veterans. Can you tell us some of the projects that you're involved in?
Yeah, you know, when Who Will Stand came out, I would get phone calls from lots of different veterans organizations, which is great. You know, there's lots of people out there volunteering or starting 501c3s or something, and it's great that they're all trying to help veterans. And they would call me because they want to, like, radio shows like your own, or they would want copies of the DVDs for their organization so they could try to, you know, do the good that they want to do. So one of the first ones was, there was a radio show called Forgotten Promise, and that was part of an organization called the Veterans Transition Resource Center, which is here in Las Vegas where I live. So I became a part of volunteering, and I'm on the board of the Veterans Transition Resource Center. And they do great work. Veterans helping veterans is pretty much what it is. And I give them as much time as I can whenever I'm not working and trying to make a living, doing other stuff. But the fact that every single person in that organization is a volunteer and that no one's being paid is great. And when we were doing Who Will Stand, one of the first organizations that opened their arms to me and their doors to me to give me access to veterans was the Wounded Warrior Project. They have since grown so tremendously that that's become the, just this gigantic organization. It's a little bit more difficult for me. You know, they, I used to be able to just call one guy, and I'd call one guy, and he'd say, sure, come on down. We're doing a Wounded Warrior ride. Yeah, you can travel with us. You know, it was very easy access, easy access to be able to talk to veterans whenever I wanted. And I guess whenever an organization starts to make as much money as they make, there became a whole legal team behind it and everything, and it just became more difficult, you know, understandably so, I guess. But the Veterans Transition Resource Center is completely volunteer. They help veterans in whatever it is that they need, whether it's, you know, help with the VA, help with filling out forms with the VA, or help getting the rating that they feel like they deserve, or they've been turned down, lots of things that you deal with all the time, or just getting a job, or different types of therapy. They entertain just about every different type of therapy, because I wish there was one therapy that worked for everyone, but there's not. So they're always researching equine therapy and dog therapy and massage therapy and, you know, meditation, all kinds of, you know, they're trying to make it as available to whatever a service member's issues are. So service members come in with all different types of things that they may need. They may be homeless and they just need a place to stay, or they may need a job, or they may be on the verge of divorce, or they got arrested for domestic violence and they're looking for some help. So they really do. And let me tell you something, when you put a veteran on a mission, you know, to help another veteran, they don't take no for an answer. And for a lot of these guys who are struggling and they've had a door slammed in their face, you know, when they've gone to the VA, not to just pick on the VA, but, you know, these guys don't, they can't handle a lot of no's before they just throw their hands up and go, forget it. And then they're on their own.
That's very true. Now, our show is nationwide, so if there's some veterans out in the Las Vegas area, how would they reach out to the Volunteer Veteran Transition Resource Center? Is there a phone number or a website?
Yeah, sure. I can actually look up the number. Like, that's how available they are. I'm actually going to put out the number to the CEO, and he doesn't mind. This guy answers the phone 24/7, and he has never complained to me about me giving out his personal number, because this is all he does. And he realizes that when somebody needs help, it doesn't always happen between 9 and 5 Monday through Friday. So anytime. His name is Jim Littner, which is Littner, and his number is, and he, you know, doesn't say have them call the center, because the center is not open 24/7, but he is. And his number is 702-524-4933. That's 702-524-4933, Jim Littner. You just can't inundate this guy with phone calls. He will pass it on to somebody, and he will make sure that you get help and whatever it is that you need.
Well, that's really great. Hey, David, do you have any follow-up questions?
I sure do, and hopefully you can hear me now, Phil. I'm sorry about that technical.
I can hear you now.
Before. Oh, great. Well, Phil, since you're going to be on our show, I read your book, Why Can't You Tickle Yourself? And I was really impressed with it. It's a great book, and I wanted, before we run out of time, I'd like you to tell our listeners about that and what they can learn from that book and why they need to read it.
Well, you know, part of what I teach in my seminar is, you know, the number one fear of most Americans is public speaking. And for a lot of us, it doesn't really affect our lives all too much if your job doesn't require you to do that. But I started out writing the book specifically for actors because, you know, the number one fear of most actors, is being the center of attention. You know, and it is problematic if your job requires you to be the center of attention. I became a cast. I used to teach the course, but I didn't write the book until I became a casting director, because I could tell you that the number one killer of actors in an audition is nervousness. If you're nervous at an audition, you're not going to get the part. I grew up a painfully shy kid. Never in a million years thought that I would be an actor. When I was in college, I took acting as an elective, not because I wanted to be an actor, but because I thought, how can you fail acting? I mean, there were other electives I could have taken and failed, but I knew nothing about acting. But I figured if I just show up and try, even if I suck at it, I should get a B just for trying. So I really did it just to keep up my grade point average. And I just happened to have a brilliant first acting instructor. His name was Sterling. Never saw him after college. And he taught us why people get nervous being the center of attention, how they got that way, and how to get over it permanently. Because it is something that you can get over. Now, I found out that he changed me from a painfully shy kid to somebody who could actually be an actor, somebody who doesn't get nervous at all whenever I have to give a speech or get up in front of a group and teach or no matter what I do. And this changed my life because I would have avoided so many things if I thought I was going to have to get up and talk in front of people. So then, later on down the line, I found out that the people that were calling me that wanted to take my course, a lot of them were lawyers, trial lawyers, or just wanting to be trial lawyers. And then I found out that I had never met a trial lawyer who was not inspired to be a trial lawyer from a dramatic courtroom scene in a movie. Like, wow. These young guys would see Denzel Washington in Philadelphia, and they would say, that's what I want to do. I want to be a trial lawyer. That's what I want to do. So they go to law school, they graduate, they take the bar exam, they pass. They get in front of a jury, and they very quickly find out, I am not Denzel Washington. I'm nervous. I'm sweating. It looks like I'm lying. I can't get over this nervousness. And nervousness really, you know, comes across as a lot of times as lying. And you guys could probably attest to this. I've heard it so many times. I mean, there are so many lawyers who know of another lawyer who can walk into a courtroom and just wow the courtroom. Like, they're funny, they can make people cry, they're charismatic, and they win cases almost on personality. I was more prepared than they were, but they got in front of the jury, and the jury just sided with them because they liked him, because they thought he was interesting or funny or true or whatever it was. And when you see lawyers that have been very successful, the Johnny Cochrans of the world, they are. They get into a courtroom, and they're fun to watch. So, you know, we have to realize that the jury is not 12 lawyers. It's 12 average everyday people that don't know anything about law. And because they're average everyday people, they can be very easily influenced by a charismatic personality. So lawyers have been taking my course because they just want to be more convincing. They just want to be more influential when they have to go into a case and it comes down to basically the jury decides, not me, not the judge, not you. The jury's going to decide. And the jury is going to side with the person they believe is telling the truth. And it's funny that I bring up Denzel Washington because he said it in Philadelphia perfectly. He said, today you're going to hear two truths, ours and theirs. And it's your job to sift through layer upon layer of evidence and decide which version is most true. And I love that line because it's not that one lawyer is lying and the other is telling the truth. They're both telling their side of the same story. But the jury's going to side with the person they believe is most true. So, you know, believability is everything.
One thing on that, because prior to doing the work that I'm doing with David, I did a lot of jury trials, both civil and criminal. And you were talking about convincing the jurors. Most of the time, it's about convincing a juror.
Yes.
And what you want to do is when you whether it's a criminal trial with 12 jurors or 6 jurors in a civil case, if you start to have eye contact with a juror, and you can sense that juror is believing what you're saying, you don't leave that juror. You stay right there, because if you can convince that juror, that may be enough.
And that's very true, and it could be, you know. Now, and it's sort of like stand-up comedians. You know, a stand-up comedian will come out, and if there's some person that's just loving, laughing so hard they're crying, that person, that laughter becomes contagious, you know. So it's sort of the same theory. Now, of course, as a stand-up comedian, you want to make everybody laugh. But it usually starts with one person, and sometimes that one person's laughter is so contagious that it whips the rest of the audience into a frenzy. And you're absolutely right, because, you know, it starts with that one person, and that person's going to go into deliberation, and they're going to fight for you, you know, and hopefully that will be enough. But there's so much involved in being able to control, you know, I used to call it the manipulation technique. I really call it influence now. Influence is a softer word. But as actors, that's what we do. You know, as an actor, you need to be able to get an audience to laugh, cry, think, or feel whatever you want them to laugh, cry, think, or feel about. And there is a way to be able to do that. You know, most acting classes teach you this inside-out technique. You know, if I feel it, you're going to feel it. Well, this is really an outside-in technique. It's understanding the audience better than they understand themselves. So that you know, and one of the people that I had taken a seminar with that I had seen was Frank Abagnale. And Frank Abagnale is the guy that they did the movie Catch Me If You Can about. Leonardo DiCaprio played Frank Abagnale. And he was doing a seminar, and I went to the seminar because I wanted to know, how did you convince people that you were a lawyer? Or how did you convince people that you were a doctor? Never went to medical school, never went to law school. How did you do that? He is an expert in human behavior and a master manipulator. And I thought, I can take these two things if I could master that, and I can use that to become an actor. Being able to be an expert in human behavior and a master manipulator. And that's really what I teach lawyers, and I teach entrepreneurs and corporate executives, because not everybody becomes a corporate executive because they want to talk in front of groups of people. And for a lot of them, that's the part of their job they hate. Well, I can help them not hate it.
If I could just ask one more question, we're about out of time. But, Phil, how can our listeners find out more about these seminars that you've mentioned?
Well, I have a website, because the seminar is now called Mastering Influence for Success. So if you go to masteringinfluenceforsuccess.com, it'll take you to my website. You can send me an email. And I'll be happy to tell you more about it.
Well, that's great.
That's great.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Over to you, Richard.
No, I was just going to say the same thing. Bill, we could talk all night, and I hope you'll come back on our show again. We can, you know, kind of get into more details about some of the, you know, the PTSD and the PTSD with MSD. And very fascinating show, and thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Absolutely. I'd come back anytime you guys want. And thank you guys for the work you do. You guys are doing so much great work. It's absolutely been an honor to be on your show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Take care and good luck.
Take care, guys.
Yep. Thanks. Well, we're about out of time. It's been a fascinating interview with our special guest, Phil Valentine. For those of you that may have tuned in late, you can listen to our archived podcast. It will be available on our website in a few days. Meanwhile, we'll have to wrap it up for this evening. We'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio. I'd like to thank our producer, Mr. Doug Newsom, and we'd ask you to please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Have a great week.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.